We're so glad you've chosen GoldSeek.com Radio. Today's featured guest, Dr. Stephen Lee. Our featured guest today has over 25 years of investment experience, author of several bestsellers, and we'll let him get into all the details of the latest and near the end of this broadcast. How's the weather today, Dr. Stephen Lieb in the New York area?
Well, you know, Chris, if you had called me about an hour and a half ago, I would have said it was sunny and really beautiful. Now it appears to be getting overcast, and I hear we're going to get very, very cold weather coming in pretty soon. Days, I mean, really, really cold weather.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, maybe it's the last, you know, shots over the bow before spring. Let's certainly hope.
Yes, yes, that could be it.
Very good. Well, I wanted to begin, if we could, today with the U.S. equities markets. This is what people want to hear about. We had Dr. Burton Malkiel on recently. He claims we're way extended when he looks at his CAPE index, the Case-Shiller price-to-earnings metric. He's just concerned that over the long term, we'll see more of a return to the mean, that the pendulum is likely to swing back towards reality. Any comments here?
Well, I think that, you know, you have to start out with the assumption or the realization that most of the models of the stock market have been based upon, the period probably beginning in 1929 and going through beginning of the century or mid-century, et cetera. And I think we're now in an entirely different period. And I think what's high and what's low and what defines valuation, et cetera, are really different rules that apply. I'm not sure that we understand all the rules quite yet, and I'm not sure, you know, that they're fully in place yet, but I am pretty sure that we're in a world that's changing in a fairly dramatic way. And, you know, a very good friend of mine who's been enormously successful at a lot of different things, among them making money, classifies today as the most disturbing time in modern history, literally. That I think is a quote from him, most disturbing time in modern history. And, you know, it's somebody that he's not always right. No one is. But, you know, he's got a historian's perspective on things. And I think that, you know, it is a very disturbing time. It's an exceptionally disturbing time. I mean, you know, you just look at what's going on in Europe. Between the haves and have-nots, whether you're talking about in a military sense, which is certainly the case between Russia and the Ukraine, or you're talking about it in an economic sense, which is the case with Germany and Greece, you just know that there's a lot of situations in the world right now which are, you know, all possible points of inflection, and all could lead to I don't want to say chaos, but could lead to, you know, major changes. I continue to believe that, China is, that things are gravitating from west to east, that things are headed toward China. They appear to be best positioned, in my opinion, for what could be an entirely new and different type of world than one we've experienced up to now. We, meaning those that, you know, were alive at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and, you know, up to people that are alive today.
You talk about reaching a threshold, an inflection point, a pivot point, where that chaotic system might just tip, you know, that tipping point that chaos theorists are.
Yeah.
And I think this is so key because you're echoing the sentiments of so many of the great guests we've been fortunate enough to have on the show. Everyone has a different perspective, but the arrows are starting to line up in the same vector here. And I wonder if you might try to look forward and give us an idea of what that tipping point might be.
It could be something as small, and I say small as the economic equivalent might be, you know, Greece leaving the European Union, the Eurozone. I don't think they'll necessarily leave it this time, but, Greece with its 50% youth unemployment rate and Germany, which is running, you know, not full throttle, but certainly doing extremely well, they really can't be in the same monetary system and, you know, really share the same currency. It just doesn't make sense. And, you know, tipping point could be they're dropping out. A tipping point could be, a bigger war war in the Ukraine. And, you know, a tipping point could be, you know, ISIS making headway into Saudi Arabia, or the Houthis making a headway into Saudi Arabia. I mean, there are so many areas of the world where we are extremely vulnerable, not just in a geopolitical sense, but also in an economic sense. And I do think that we're headed for a world in which the dollar will no longer reign supreme. I think we're going to head back toward some sort of metallic monetary standard, one in which gold and its correlates, you know, have a much more active role to play. You know, I'm not sure exactly what that'll look like right now, but, you know, I would guess something, you know, along the lines of Bretton Woods. And it just seems inevitable to me that that's where we're going. And I think that it's why I'm writing my next book, just basically as a case for gold and, you know, how we got into this situation. I mean, America has become a country in which, you know, there's no more long term in America. Everything is short term. Everything is, you know, today's success. And, you know, how have you done, you know, in the last 10 minutes? This is not the way to plan out a century or plan out, you know, another 20 or 50 years. This is just, you know, instant gratification. And that's been a long time coming. You know, we were a country that, you know, really cherished our savings and our ability to, you know, use our savings to invest, et cetera. That's just gone by the wayside, Chris.
This is a first. You know, in nearly a decade here on the show weekly, I think that was the first time a guest has proposed a new Bretton Woods-like agreement. Europe was the straw man at that meeting, and of course the United States was the giant in the room. This time, China and other BRIC nations perhaps dominating.
You would. I mean, it's not so much BRIC nations per se, but it's, yeah, I mean, it would certainly be China. And I think the Eurasia and perhaps parts of Eastern Europe, maybe even extending as far as Germany, you know, would be the kind of bloc you'd be looking at. As I said, everything's moving east. I mean, the data that I think I saw yesterday, I mean, you can mention it, but I just wanted people to realize I'm not 100% sure. But I believe that China bought all the gold that was available, all the gold that was mined, and that could have been bought in January. They're obviously accumulating literally as much gold as there is out there to be accumulated. At least they did in January, and I think all along they've been accumulating tremendous amounts of gold. I mean, the numbers you see from China have all been coming out of Hong Kong. But now China has their own gold exchanges, and an awful lot of that gold that is traded on that exchange ends up, you know, it is gold bars in either Chinese banks or, you know, wherever, stored, et cetera. I have no idea how much gold China has, but I think it's a lot more than upper-end guesses would suggest. You know, they're preparing very deliberately, very relentlessly for, you know, a new type of world order, a new world order.
Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head with the PBOC and their precious metals operations. We have simply no idea. It's a big wild card how much of the metal has been accumulated because, as I'm sure you know, they only give us a glimpse into that. I think it's every 5 years. You know, 2015 started out similarly to 2014. We had gold, silver moving sharply higher in tandem. And then January marked the best monthly gain yet again for the yellow metal this year, due in no small part, I'm sure you'd probably concur, with global currency issues. You know, we saw the madness in Switzerland, trouble in Greece. I wonder if you might give us an idea of whether or not this could be the year that we do find the floor.
I think there's a good chance we found the floor or have come very close to the floor, you know, in the 1100s for gold. I guess mid, low 1100s. I don't think we'll go much below that. In fact, I don't even think we'll, you know, we may have already tested that. The real question for me, and tested successfully, the real question for me is when do we start, you know, the new and great bull market, one that I think could take us all the way up to 10,000. I doubt that it'll be this year. I think more likely next year or 2017, something like that. But it's going to happen. And when it does happen, it's going to be, you'll know it. I mean, there'll be no doubt it's happening.
That's an interesting point, and you just sparked this memory for some reason. You might recall over history, we've had a tendency for, particularly during the 90s, that is, where we had more liberal-oriented administrations in place, stocks simply outperformed virtually every other asset. And then when more conservatives came into play in the Oval Office, of course, you saw the commodities simply skyrocket. It tends to be a correlation there. So it's interesting that your 2016-2017 thesis coincides with the most likely change in the guard, if you will, in party lines.
There could be, I mean, you know, a definite change in the guard. And a change in the guard would be one that, you know, is not so favorably disposed toward the Fed. And if that's the case, you know, ironically, you're going to see big deficits in the government budget, probably used to induce growth rather than just, you know, throw money away. Though those growth-oriented policies, which I think you will see, if you got a change in government, would probably set the stage for a lot more inflation, commodity scarcity. And you're certainly going to see that in India, and I think you're going to see it more than people expect in China. So, yeah, I think the stage could be set for, that's a good point about the election, 2016, 2017, depending on, you know, how that turns out. A president from the other party would ironically be more, would be more disposed toward growth created by, let's say, industry-government partnerships rather than just the Fed. I mean, you know, we're in a world right now in which the Fed writes and controls monetary policy completely. European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve Board, I mean, these are the two most important policymakers in the world today. You know, my guess is I'm not taking a moral or a political making a moral or political judgment on this, but I don't think that this has resulted in great things. I mean, I think that you've got, you know, vast inequalities across the globe, and countries inequalities are enormous. And, you know, the other day, Jeb Bush went to Michigan, and I think that's a state a Republican hasn't carried probably since Romney or someone, presidential candidate, maybe Reagan carried it, I'm not sure. But, and he spoke about, you know, the middle classes and bringing growth back, boosting the middle classes. Well, you're not, obviously not going to do that with zero interest rates. Just not working. You may have a, you know, a completely new a calculus for governing the economy than the one we've been operating under the last six and what promises to be 8 years. And it could be very interesting.
Well, you brought up one of my favorite topics, calculus. So give us integration by parts. Give us the derivative here. Give us the double integration where we can revitalize the middle class. I would like for us to evaluate the integral in such a way that it can reestablish the heartland and the backbone of the United States.
It starts and ends with infrastructure. You know, this massive infrastructure deficit. I mean, and I think it will be, you know, infrastructure that is the key buzzword for the next at least decade, maybe next generation. You know, you're talking about a need for, you know, many, many, many trillions of dollars of infrastructure spending to, you know, get the world on a fairly decent foundation, pardon the pun. I think that's where, you know, money will be spent. And it's interesting that this world of ours, or at least this country of ours, has morphed from a so-called military-industrial complex, which had its own problems under Eisenhower. I mean, that was Eisenhower's, I think, farewell speech, where he referred to the military-industrial complex and that we have to watch this. And he's right. You do. There are risks to a military-industrial complex. But we've gone too far in the other direction. And, you know, what we have now, rather than a military-industrial complex, I think we have a financial-legal complex. Finance and legal and lawyers and investment bankers really do very little in terms of creating real productivity in the economy and creating the kinds of infrastructure that allow transportation to flow, that allow water to flow, that allow for cheaper energy and more sustainable energies. You know, it's these kinds of things and these kinds of goals that I think China gets and has been, you know, very busy implementing that we just don't have any clues about. I mean, we tend to be very short-sighted, and I think one of my favorite examples has become, you know, the idea of a wind turbine. You know, a wind turbine, how it takes a while to build. There's a tremendous upfront cost. And, you know, so you're building something, you're spending a lot of money, and you're not getting anything in return right away. You sometimes have to wait years. But, you know, at the end of a certain period of time, you've got a massive amount of free energy, you know, for, you know, 20, 30 years. We don't approach things in that fashion. We want results here and now. And I think that has to change. We have to become much more long-term oriented in this country in order to really, you know, create something good. And I think there's a good chance we will. The Chinese certainly get it. And I think, you know, they're going to take a lot of their Asian and Eurasian partners along with them. Even places like Saudi Arabia, China's been involved in creating renewable energies there, solar energy in Saudi Arabia, believe it or not. It's changing, and we're going to have to take a lesson from the East if we're going to keep up and want to be you know, a significant part of the new economic structure.
Integrating into that structure, I think, will pose incredible challenges. It's going to require leadership.
I think it's going to require much higher caliber leadership. I think that we have to take lessons from China without becoming enamored of China. And, you know, one of the lessons that you take from China is you go back to Confucius, which is, what, 2,500 years ago, something like that. I mean, he's still there. I mean, you know, people still, you know, quote Confucius. He's part of the body politic in China right now, you know, has been for the last 2,500 years. And, you know, he was the one that brought up the idea of a meritocracy. Now, China's not a complete meritocracy. We all know that. I mean, you know, she's been very busy rooting out corruption. But I think we have to buy more into that idea that people are equal. Give everybody a chance. Give people more of a chance and be long viewed in terms of doing things. A lot of what, you know, China does, they are long viewed. They're meritocratic. It's the kind of stuff that we used to do. And we used to do it really, really well. But we've sort of lost our way over the past, well, I, you know, honestly would date it in the very early 70s, we lost our way. It was like once we went off the gold standard and we remained the reserve currency in the world, I mean, we sort of had our cake and could eat it too, spend whatever we wanted, and really didn't have to answer to anyone. There were no constraints on what we could do, and we did everything. I think we've got to get back to a much more disciplined way of life in order to you know, really succeed. But I think there's a good chance that we will, a very good chance.
Studying last night China's history, we all know gunpowder, all these amazing scientific achievements that emanated from that land. But fewer folks, I think, realize that it was initially an elixir given to the emperors to extend longevity. That's the origins of saltpeter as we know it today. We can learn, and we can adjust, and we can adapt, and we must. And I think you've underscored and highlighted that so well. So let me shift over here to a related topic, and that is exchange-traded funds, the ETPs. They are showing huge inflows relative to the last 3 years of the yellow metal. Folks are stepping up. They want to add that gold to their portfolios. The ETFs have to accumulate huge bullion bars. Do you see this as a fundamental shift, a sea change that could bode well?
I mean, I see it's certainly part of a sea change. I mean, the last thing people would expect in the face of a dollar, which has been on a, you know, near historic tear. I mean, you know, just absolutely rising in a, you know, massive way. The last thing people would see, would expect would be a gold, you know, a gold rally, a strong gold market. I mean, you know, typically there's the association reflexive it may be, but there's still this association between a strong dollar and weak gold, and weak gold and a strong dollar. So that, I mean, and weak dollar, strong gold. But to see the dollar and gold both, you know, firm together is very unusual and really does suggest that gold is ignoring the quote bad news of the strong dollar. And I think that's very positive for the yellow metal. It is extremely positive.
People that I read online and elsewhere are pointing to the crude oil implosion and bracing for a commodity market implosion, and particularly the precious metals. But, you know, I can't help but wonder if maybe that is short-sighted, pointing back to 2007, 2008. Crude oil had its big run and then collapsed, and the credit crisis seemed to follow. But I don't see that occurring this time, and I wonder if you share those thoughts.
I think that low oil prices are, you know, they're a mixed bag in the U.S., but, you know, more positive than negative. I don't see any, you know, major vulnerabilities here. I think the stock market is certainly overvalued, and you mentioned a guest that you had that said it was extremely overvalued. Yeah, you can, you know, I wouldn't argue with that. But typically, in order to get stocks, in order to create a major catastrophe, you need a catalyst. And yeah, that could happen in Europe. That could happen, I don't know, I guess in Russia, in the Ukraine. I'm not sure exactly what form it would take there. It could certainly happen in Saudi Arabia with ISIS, etc. But, you know, absent a catalyst, you're not really going to see a downturn in the market. I mean, and, you know, $50 oil, remember, came after the market started falling. That was basically in, I think, 2009. We had $50 oil, and then it quickly shot up again to 70, 80, and then eventually about 120. And then, you know, you've had this downturn. And the downturn is very curious. I mean, it certainly has a far different look to it than it did in 2008, 2009.
As this discussion winds down a bit, just touch on the interesting development with the ruble market. You know, we saw cracks in the seams in that currency, and you alluded to currency weakness with the dollar soaring, resulted from the oil implosion. And we saw gold increase by just over 100% in just 7 weeks' time. I've been posing this to the guests on the show, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about the abruptness of that climb and whether or not we might see something similar in terms of gold relative to dollars in the coming years.
Oh, I think you definitely will. I mean, I think that, you know, again, when gold starts going, I mean, you'll know it. And it'll be absolutely, you know, breathtaking. And, you know, people won't take advantage of it. They'll just say, well, it'll pull back, and it won't pull back. And that's usually the hallmark of, you know, a major bull market. And that will start. I mean, you know, it could start next week, but my guess is that it's still about 18 to 24 months away before you really see it start, before you go through the old highs of what, around 1900. But as far as the ruble goes, I think I'm not bearish on the ruble right here, to be very honest. I think that oil prices are likely to come back. Sort of surprised. I know this sounds ridiculous, but I'm kind of surprised the ruble's held up as well as it has. And I think one reason it's not at 100 rather than 65, the Chinese. I think the Chinese have been very active in Russia, and I think they've created sort of a floor in the Russian economy. And I think that's part of their Eurasian, Middle Eastern, Eastern strategy. And that's you know, what I think about the ruble. I wouldn't mind owning the ruble. I mean, if I would be a buyer rather than a seller of the ruble right now, today. And the other thing that could happen with the ruble is it might end up as part of a currency basket with the yuan and maybe even the mark if the euro breaks away. I mean, these are not predictions, you know, per se. Possibilities that can happen in the kind of world that we live in. I mean, you really can't rule out a whole lot of stuff, but you cannot rule out a new currency basket in which the ruble and the yuan and the mark and maybe some other currencies share a role and are convertible into gold. And you have, again, a Bretton Woods type of monetary system that at least governs the eastern part of the world and may, you know, spread to the west. So that anything is on the table, almost anything is on the table here. I mean, it's very difficult to see how things are going to play out other than to say that this is the time in which things are changing. You know, my friends were disturbing. It's a very, very disturbing, distressing, upsetting world that we're living in today on so many different levels, in so many different ways. And typically, these kinds of situations give birth to, you know, a new world order. And I think that's exactly what we're going to see over the next 5 years.
Bretton Woods Part 2. What an interesting thought. This is food for cogitation. I know my listeners are going to be digesting this discussion for some time. Dr. Stephen Leeb, we want to thank you.
Always my pleasure. I really like talking to you so much.
here is your mining quiz for the day. Compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.